You're listening to KOWS 107.3 FM, Occidental, California. A little problem in the studio this morning. Ha, ha, ha. And on the phone, we have Professor Joseph Tainter. Good day, sir.
Good day.
Really appreciate you coming on the show here. We had a little problem in the studio earlier with the telephone setup, but it just got fixed about a minute ago. So we're saved at the last moment. Let me catch up here. Professor Joseph Tainter is with the Department of Environment and Society at Utah State University. He is an anthropologist, an archaeologist, and a historian, and the author most prominently of an influential book called The Collapse of Complex Societies. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I've heard good things about this show.
Well, we try. Yeah, we're doing all right for amateurs. I don't know. Yeah, we're doing fine. Thank you very much.
Sounds like it.
Professor, would you care to flesh out your interview, your introduction a little more, if you feel that it's appropriate?
Well, I began my career as an archaeologist. Quite a few years ago, too many that I care to remember or acknowledge. And in the 1980s, I became interested in the concept, the idea of why did ancient societies seem sometimes simply to collapse, that is, to suddenly change to a lower level of what we call complexity. The primary examples being, say, the Dark Ages in Europe after the collapse of the Roman Empire, and the great loss of civilization and population in the Maya lowlands after the Maya collapse of the 9th century AD. So I became interested in this topic, and I did a study of it. It's in the book that I think you just mentioned. But as I was doing the study, I realized that what I was learning was not just about ancient societies, that in fact it had lessons for us today and for our own future. So about 15 or 16 years ago, I began shifting my emphasis, doing less and less archaeology and writing more about the implications of what I had found for our own sustainability, for the future of our own societies, the future of the industrialized societies of the world. And that's been my topic for some time now. I work in areas of energy and complexity, sustainability and energy, and most recently in innovation. Innovation, we often think, is a major component of our future. We think that we can rely on innovation to provide us with a sustainable future. Excuse me. And some of my research is currently investigating that.
My experience with your work, I've been reading during the past week some of the papers. Some of the papers and some of your writing. I find it somewhat esoteric. I feel that it's very, it's oriented toward your particular disciplines, toward the higher level of your disciplines. And while I understand some of the fundamental concepts here, much of it strikes me as rather subtle. So what I'd like to ask you during this conversation is to please meet us halfway.
I'll be happy
and
to try.
I'm perfectly comfortable with you, expressing the higher concepts of your craft or of your science or your study. But I also want to make this as intelligible as possible to the average Joe, and you're speaking to one of those right now. So. I guess we'll dive in. I mean, just to give a little bit of flavor, let's see, I'm fumbling here. That's not a good sign. There was a paper. Oh, dear. Hold on one second. Nope, it's not going to happen. Okay. My apologies. Let's see. I'm interested in your analysis of our current society, of what the signs that you see indicate to you, what our prospects may or may not be, and and like that. And I guess I should back up a minute and say that, that the heart of your work is the notion that complexity sometimes under certain conditions leads directly to collapse. Do I have that right?
In short.
All right.
That's the short version of it.
All right. So, I'm doing a lousy job so far. Help me out here.
Okay. Well, sir, if I get too professorial, just tell me to knock it off. But these are important topics, and I find that when I speak often to general audiences, and I find that people understand complexity because they experience it in their daily lives. People's lives today are congested and complicated and complex, and so they understand what I mean by complexity. To understand our society today, or to understand any society at a point in time, you have to look at the long-term history. Because the processes that lead a society to either be sustainable or not develop over long periods of time. Now, one of the common things about human societies since the development of agriculture some 12,000 years ago is that our societies have become more and more complex. And by complex, I mean two things. First, we developed more parts. So, for example, in ancient hunting and gathering societies, there might have been something like a few dozen types of social personalities, a few dozen types of roles. Whereas, in contrast, modern censuses recognize something like 50,000, 60,000 types of distinct occupations. Right. So we've developed more and more parts. We have more and more social institutions, more roles. We process more and more types of information. So that's part of complexity. Part of complexity is more and more parts to the society. Now, in people's everyday lives, this means more and more things to do, more and more activities. I mean, parents of young children know how congested their lives are, getting the kids to all of the activities that they're involved in now and that mostly didn't exist when I was a youngster. And this is stressful. It makes people feel harried in their lives. Having many, many options, of course, gives us great opportunities, but it also makes people feel harried. But going along with more and more parts is more and more organization. Organization is what binds it all together. Organization is what causes all of these parts to work together as a coherent whole, as a coherent system. Let me give an example. And the example I like to give is the aftermath of the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. Stop and think about what our response to that has been, or at least the response most immediately. We developed new government agencies, Department of Homeland Security, Transportation Security Administration. We reorganized other agencies. So this is all more and more parts. We developed more parts. That's part of complexity. And at the same time, we developed more organization. In other words, we have established more and more controls over people's behavior so that you now spend your time in long lines at the airport getting scrutinized for security purposes. You have to fill out new kinds of forms if you do certain types of financial transactions. And these are the common kinds of responses that a society makes when it encounters problems. The common response to problems is to increase complexity, to develop more and more parts to cope with the problem, and more organization to cope with the problem. Now, the challenge for complexity is that it's not free. I like to say that in the world of complex societies, there's no free lunch. It's a phrase we've all heard, and it really applies here. Complexity always has a cost. Now, in people's everyday lives, the cost might come in terms of money, one of our main currencies. It might come in terms of time. It might come in terms of time, for example, spending in a security line at an airport. It might come in terms of annoyance, having to fill out forms at the bank if you're doing certain kinds of financial transactions. So the complexity always costs. But ultimately, the cost is energy, because everything in our society runs on energy. a person's time is ultimately paid for by energy, primarily petroleum. Money originates because our society is very wealthy in energy, and this allows us to do a lot of different kinds of things and to have the economy that we have now. So complexity and energy go together. They form almost a spiral. As one goes up, the other has to go up. As complexity increases, energy has to increase also. And so this is the situation that we're in today, the energy complexity spiral. Cheap energy allows our society to grow more complex. It allows people to do different kinds of things, to engage in different kinds of activities. It allows businesses to bring out all of the new products that people enjoy. But at the same time, just given the world that we live in, problems arise, and the problems themselves require more complexity.
Always.
And so the energy and the complexity go up and up.
There is no alternative to increased complexity when we're faced with problems.
Well, as long as you can afford it. See, complexity is neither good nor bad. It's either useful and affordable or it's not. People tend to think of complexity in a negative sense as something that's burdensome. But in fact, complexity is very useful in solving problems. Think of how we've increased the complexity of our automobiles over the last few decades, beginning in the 1970s when we started putting pollution controls on automobile engines. And now, look at, say, the development of hybrid vehicles, which now have two engines. It's a more complex automobile, and it has to have hardware and software to control both of those engines and make them work together. It's the development of new parts and new organization for the parts. But at the same time, these are costly. It costs to have a more complex automobile. You may not see the difference right away, but you're probably going to see it down the road when those things have to be repaired. So this is how complexity develops. It develops in large part as we try to solve problems.
Wouldn't increased complexity make us more vulnerable?
Excuse me, I'm going to turn up the volume on my phone just a second.
Okay,
could you repeat that?
Yes, I'm asking if increased complexity leads to a greater vulnerability or implies a greater vulnerability.
It does in some ways. For example, just think of the global supply chains that we now rely on to bring us the products that we either want or that we absolutely need. It's sometimes said that no city has more than about a 3-day supply of food. And coal-powered electric plants generally have only about a 20-day supply on hand. Mm-hmm. So it is these supply chains that do, in fact, make us vulnerable, because if there's a disruption at some point in one of these supply chains, something else, possibly something important, is going to shut down. There may not be food at the grocery store.
Yeah.
So, yes, connections, interconnectedness, and supply chains do, in fact, make us vulnerable.
Right. You say that complexity is unusual, or it has been unusual throughout human history.
Yes, and this is something that people should reflect on, because people are born into a way of life. We grow up in a modern society, and most of us think that that's a normal way to live. In a statistical sense, looking at the long duration of human history, the way we live today is highly abnormal. Most of human history, we have lived in societies of relatively lower complexity, relatively simpler societies that required much less energy to sustain them. So that today, our societies require, as I say, great amounts of energy, and this imposes a burden that we have to continually meet.
Yeah, and we're coming up against diminishing resources.
Eventually, yes. It's not clear exactly when. There is extensive discussion about what's called peak oil. Peak oil is the point where 50% of your proven reserves have been recovered. And when you reach the point of peak oil, it may be possible through heroic efforts to keep production up for a few years, but eventually production starts to decline.
Yeah.
And what that means is that there will be less and less oil available in the world every year thereafter. We don't know when we're going to hit peak oil. The United States hit peak oil in the late 1960s, and that was followed a few years later by the oil crisis of 1973. But talking about peak oil at the global level is very difficult, because you can only you can only identify that you've hit peak oil in hindsight. You can only look back and say, yes, that was when we hit it. Some people think we've hit peak oil already. World oil production has not increased since late 2004. So some people think that, in fact, we have hit the peak of oil production in the global economy. That's not entirely clear because, to a large extent, the statistics are probably being modified by the economic downturn, that because of the economic downturn, we're using less energy than would be the case if the economy was continuing to move right along. But eventually the day will come, because supplies of petroleum are finite. Eventually the day will come when we will hit peak oil, and we need to have alternative energy production in place before we hit that. If we don't have alternatives in place by that point, then the party will be over. Our way of life will go away very quickly.
Well, there's a book by that name, The Party's Over. And
I'm sorry, could you speak up a little?
Oh, yes. There's a book named called The Party's Over.
Yes.
By Richard Heinberg.
Yes.
And what I've come to understand is that it's too little too late for us to get alternative energy sources to the degree that we would need to continue this way of life, to get these sources online. To minimize profound and possibly catastrophic interruption in the way that we've always known our lives to be. But you seem to indicate that peak oil is an unknown. We don't really know if we're at or past that point.
We know it's coming.
We know it's coming.
We don't know when. It's possible that we have already hit it. I'm not convinced of that. The International Energy Agency recently predicted that it could happen about 2020, and that's not actually that far off. So it is coming, and we do not have much time to put alternative energy systems in place. And I feel that this is something that should be the priority of all industrial nations.
And do you see evidence of this becoming a serious priority?
Well, certainly there's discussion of it, and the current administration seems to be pushing it. I don't know whether they're pushing it hard enough. This is something on which it is almost impossible to spend too much money,
mm-hmm.
Because energy is life itself. And we don't like to give a monetary value to life. We also shouldn't give a monetary value to energy. Without energy, our way of life would go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other aspect of complexity, or what complexity often implies, is eventual collapse.
What happened, as I see it, in ancient societies is that faced with problems, they grow more complex, meaning more parts, more organization, and a higher energy requirement, but without having much ability to increase energy production. These ancient societies were agricultural societies, and they depended on the sun and on human and animal labor. And there's only so much you can produce with the sun and with human and animal labor. So complexity would increase, and usually it would increase just to maintain the status quo. They were simply trying to stay afloat. So you axiomatically, you're in a situation of diminishing returns, higher and higher costs just to maintain the status quo,
mm-hmm.
and this would cause societies to become weakened, fiscally weakened. The population would become disaffected from taxation, and eventually collapse then just becomes a matter of probability as some challenge comes along that can't be overcome.
Right. And our tendency is to not really believe that collapse is possible in our society because we're so enamored of it, or we have been, or we've become so arrogant about our superiority and dominance in the Earth community and among other nations. But there are definitely signs that that collapse is a very real possibility, that we're facing what you might call a watershed moment in our human adventure.
I think we face a prospect of diminishing returns in our future, and I say this because I think that over the next 20 to 30 years, we are going to have a convergence of major, very costly problems. And addressing all of these problems is only going to result in maintaining our way of life, maintaining the status quo. Now, the major problems that I see include healthcare costs, pension costs for the baby boom generation, probably continued high military costs, and replacing our decaying infrastructure. Now, we could probably cope with any one of these, but when all of them are happening at the same time over the next 20 to 30 years, it's going to greatly raise the cost of being an industrial society. It's going to raise the cost of being American society, and there's going to be no net increase in our wealth or well-being. We're going to address these higher costs. We're going to pay these higher costs if we can, just to keep things from getting worse, just to maintain the status quo. And axiomatically, that's a condition of diminishing returns, where complexity itself becomes less and less desirable, less and less advantageous.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a situation that makes societies vulnerable to collapse. I don't think our societies are facing collapse in the near future unless there is suddenly a drastic reduction in our petroleum supplies. That would bring on a collapse.
Mm-hmm.
But what I am concerned about is a future in which the economy may not grow as we've been used to it growing. It may be in a steady state, and in which that translates into reduced opportunities for people, reduced numbers of jobs, reduced taxes to the government, and so forth and so on. In other words, stagnation.
I find it curious that you place this in the context of 20 to 30 years, when it seems to me that these things are all operable and unfolding as we speak.
Oh, they're unfolding as we speak, and they're all foreseeable, and we're not addressing them. No, I think they will converge at their worst in 20 to 30 years, but the processes are underway now.
Yeah. There's a new DVD out, called Collapse. It's produced by a man named Michael Rupert, who some of us have known for many, many years. And it's a fairly hair-raising analysis of our society. I'm wondering if you've become aware of it yet.
No, I wasn't. Actually, I'd like to look at it.
Yeah, it's called Collapse. It's very powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Should we describe, is it Jevons or Jevons paradox?
Well, the Jevons paradox is very interesting. William Stanley Jevons was a 19th century British economist who was concerned about England's supply of coal. Coal, of course, being the energy basis of Victorian society. And he was primarily concerned, he wrote a book called The Coal Question, and he was primarily concerned that England would lose its dominance because its supplies of coal would be exhausted. Of course, the flaw in his reasoning was that he couldn't foresee petroleum coming along the line. But he made one very astute observation in the book, and this is the observation for which he's famous. And that is that looking at the history of coal production and the improvement in steam engines in England, what he found was that technical improvements in the efficiency of using the resource, did not result in less of the resource being used. Instead, it resulted in even more coal being used as each steam engine became more efficient. The reason is that as the cost of using coal declined because engines became more efficient, people simply responded by using more of it. And so technical improvements actually led to an increase in consumption rather than a decrease. Now, we can fast forward a number of decades, and we can see the same process at work in our own society. Think about the 1970s and the multiple oil crises of 1973 and 1979, and what happened after that. What happened was that a lot of people began switching to smaller cars, little four-cylinder cars. This is when they really came to have a major share of the market in the U.S. So many people switched to more fuel-efficient cars that by the mid-1960s, about 86 or so, oil prices were beginning to decline. And they declined so much that oil became cheap again. You know, the price of oil had quadrupled in 73 and then I think doubled again in 79. And this was a major shock to people's everyday budgets, their household budgets.
Yeah.
But by the late 1980s and early 1990s, the price of oil was going so low that people could afford once again to drive large cars. And so this is what brought about the popularity of sport utility vehicles.
Right.
It happened because technical improvements in the efficiency of engines made the cost of driving so low that people responded by driving more miles and buying larger vehicles. It's the same process that Jevons talked about with coal, that when you have a technical improvement and reduce the cost of using a resource, use of the resource actually goes up. It doesn't go down. So this is one reason why I am not so optimistic, why I don't share the optimism in technology as saving us in the future. I'm not convinced that hybrid vehicles will result in any actual fuel savings. In fact, one of the dilemmas that I pose to my class is, to my students, I tell them, you have a choice to buy a car, and it's limited to two choices. You can buy a Prius or you can buy a Hummer. And I ask them, tell me which one you're going to buy and why. And, of course, most of the students say that they'd buy the Prius. They think that's the proper answer to give. One or two honest ones acknowledge that they'd really like to have the Hummer instead. The answer, I think, is that if everyone bought a Hummer, we would probably save more fuel in the long run than if everyone bought a Prius. Now, I'm not downplaying any particular brands of cars. I'm simply using these as examples. The reason is that if everyone was driving a Hummer, it would be so costly to run them that they'd be parked a good bit of the time. A Prius is so inexpensive to run that people would simply use it a lot more, and in the aggregate, we'd use more fuel than ever before. So this is the challenge of technological efficiency. Technological improvements help, but they only help for a short time. And in the end, they set the seeds of their own demise, making it necessary to continually innovate in technical areas.
Yeah. It seems to be, in a sense, damned if you do and damned if you don't. I assume this is the most complex society ever on the face of the earth.
Yes.
And you speak about diminishing returns as a inevitable unfolding of increased complexity and organization. And you also speak that there's no way to really win. You say, let's see if I can find it here. Oh God.
Well, that's the athletic metaphor that I like to use.
Yeah.
That there is, I think of sustainability as a game, but it's an unusual game. Because there's no point at which you've won that is become sustainable forever.
Mm.
But conversely, it is possible to lose, to become unsustainable, to collapse, to lose your way of life.
Yeah.
But success in this game consists of staying in the game, continuing to play.
Right. So it's kind of a leapfrog. We innovate. And what appears to be saving energy or reducing the cost of our innovations leads to increased consumption of these new modalities.
Yes.
So it's really, it really is a dance that that implies that we're going to be challenged. Yet as long as we're on this earth, we're going to be challenged with the unfolding of our own development. Really,
if we try to maintain the way of life to which we're accustomed, yes, we will be continually challenged. The best description that I've heard is that it's going to be perpetual whitewater.
Right. Well, it sure seems that way. My own sense as a layman, I feel in my bones that we're into the process of collapse. The lack of wisdom in plunging ahead with ways of growth, with growth paradigms and developing our material culture has certainly put us up against a historical dead end.
Well, and our political system is so dysfunctional that we're not able to address the problem.
Right.
Politicians need to have growth because that leads to full employment. And a steady state economy, in a steady state economy, it's not clear how you could maintain high levels of employment. But that may possibly what we'll be facing at some point. It's impossible to foresee when. But I keep wishing that that we could have adult conversations among our political leaders rather than each of them simply trying to score points on the others.
Well, I think the failure to do just that could well prove to be fatal to us.
It could very well, yes.
You say you contributed to this marvelous documentary called The 11th Hour, and in it you say that we need people to be aware.
Yes.
And this seems to be, it's a simple statement on the face of it, but it seems to be possibly the most crucial element in the whole puzzle.
Oh, awareness is the biggest challenge of all. As you mentioned a few minutes earlier, most people cannot conceive of the possibility that their way of life could change drastically. They simply assume, if they think about it at all, they simply assume that that the way they live, the way we live, will simply go on and on. One of the challenges I put to my students is I tell them, go into one of the local big box stores and look at the people shopping there and ask yourselves how many of those people are aware of the things that we discuss in our classes. And the answer, of course, is not very many of them.
Mm-hmm.
Not very many of them are aware of these things that you and I are talking about now.
Right. Well, this is where you come in, Professor. How about, is there another book in the making?
There is another book out. It's called Supply Side Sustainability, where I have talked about, I did it with a couple of co-authors, Timothy Allen and Thomas Hoekstra, and we talked about some of the issues that you and I have been talking about today. It's a bit of an academic book, and it's oriented largely toward natural resource management, the management of resources on the public lands and natural resources more generally. Recently, I've had an invitation that I'm considering, which is to talk about complexity, the complexity energy spiral in relationship to the oil spill, and how this spiral and having to go farther and farther and deeper for more and more inaccessible reserves of oil really made something like that almost inevitable. Requiring more and more complex technology so complex that a simple oversight, a simple mistake can have terrible, tragic complications.
Yeah.
So I am thinking about doing this. It's a book that would have to be done fairly quickly while the topic is still timely.
Right. Mistake is quite a word to apply to this. There seems to be... at least the sense that this was this was more than an innocent mistake, that that the elements of corporate, the imperatives of corporate life, select for cost cutting, corner cutting, and taking risks to optimize return on investment, etc.
You're right, but if we're going to be doing this kind of drilling, we simply have to take human nature for granted, that people will cut corners and try to maximize profits. And if we're going to be doing this, we have to develop technologies and oversight that will be robust in spite of human nature, that will prevent failures even when people do try to cut corners.
Yes. You're familiar with the precautionary principle?
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
Yeah. What else is there, Professor Tainter? What have we not touched on so far?
I think this topic of awareness is paramount. As you said, it's the most important matter of all, simply getting people to think about these things. And I have to admit that the economists are right in one sense. I have a lot of disagreements with conventional economists. I don't believe that incentives will always be enough to provide us with resources, or that innovation will always save the day. But I agree with them on one matter, and that is the usefulness of the price mechanism. Yeah. I hate to say this, but what will cause people to change consumption patterns is high prices.
Yeah.
And I don't like that. I consume energy just like everyone else does, but I think in the future energy is going to have to be a lot more expensive, and that's going to be part of the transition to a sustainable society.
Right. And it may be a blessing in disguise. I mean, there are elements of earthly life that we have pretty much traded in for our as Derek Jensen says, our comforts and elegancies.
Yes.
That we have, we've pretty much played fast and loose for a long time with the limits of the biosphere, and we find ourselves now really up against it.
That's true.
It's going to require a fundamental transformation of our social organization and our major institutions if we're going to have any sort of good human future.
Well, and this is part of the dilemma. How would we, for example, generate the wealth to cope with the effects of climate change with, say, having to resettle tens of millions of people out of coastal Bangladesh? How are we going to generate the wealth to cope with this, with these problems and the convergence of other problems that I talked about, without continuing with a growth economy? Can a steady state economy allow us to have the wealth surpluses that we need to solve the major problems that are coming in future decades? I don't know the answer to this. It is an answer we will learn.
Yeah. Well, I suspect that the realities facing us, I think we're going to see things in our lifetimes that may very well horrify us in terms of the choices that we make globally in terms of who's going to live and who's going to die.
I think you're right.
Yeah. And I don't think we're really ready for that emotionally or psychologically either. I think the whole notion of wealth has to be rethought. There's monetary wealth, and then there's the wealth of the earth, and there's the wealth of human resources. We have close to 7 billion people, and if we needed to, we could pretty much do anything within the laws of physics that we might need to do to see our way into some semblance of a livable, and I'm referring psychologically now, or even spiritually. I mean, we certainly know how to have a barbaric, how to run barbaric societies, but I don't think anybody really wants that.
No.
Yeah.
No, and you're right that a change in what people value, something other than material consumption would be enormously beneficial, I don't know how to bring it about.
No.
You know, marketing is so strong and people are so susceptible to marketing that companies making widgets pretty much have their way.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I think the whole thing is coming down. And at the same time, I think there are many, many people all over the world who are hard at work reimagining and redesigning a world that works much better than this dying world does.
The examples are out there, and in the last third or so of the 11th Hour film, there are many examples. I encourage people to see that film. It's available on DVD. There are many examples of what a sustainable future might look like, and there are people showing us the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of good news that's under the radar.
Yes.
And people need to be made aware of it, because it very well might sustain us through some very, very difficult years ahead.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Well, I want to apologize for my flustered beginning to this conversation. But
oh, quite all right.
I very much appreciate the work that you do and you coming on the show. And it's food for thought. I like to think that our lives are in our hands, and that with more understanding, and more effort to understand, that we could maybe get a grip and know that that it's not, we don't necessarily have to go down the drain.
I hope you're right.
Yeah, I hope I'm right too. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed this.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This was Joseph Tainter from Utah State University. I forgot to ask him where that is in Utah. Professor in the Department of Environment and Society, and author of an influential book, The Collapse of Complex Societies. It's a book that's 20 years old already, 22, and it's still referred to by people who deal with these sorts of understandings. Okay, we're going to take a little break and be back in a few minutes. You're listening to KOWS 107.3 FM, Occidental, California. The show's What Now, Mondays 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. My name's Ken Rose. Be back in a few minutes.